So I'm going to take a little bit of a step back from what Mark Tolman just showed you on sequencing overall and talk a little bit about what sequencing really is. I know that not everybody in the room is really familiar. We've been talking about genotyping for years. We haven't really talked about trying to get deeper in understanding the whole genetic code on these individual animals. So my part of the talk is really the lead up to Warren, where Warren really did all the work, and figure out what we can do with some of the data that we get from sequencing. That's what Warren will continue on. So I want to give you some of the background on the sequencing and why we care about it overall beyond just this regular genotyping that we've been doing lately. So overall, the genome sequence, this is a nice illustration that talks about all the base pairs that that cover the whole genome. It's basically the idea of trying to read the code, read these bases all the way across all of the chromosomes that every individual animal and every individual cattle, people, whatever, every individual has. And you'll see that I think we all know we've got our double-stranded DNA that's unwound from the chromosome. It's made up of a long antenna of base pairs that actually code for the proteins that are used to our building blocks for us and give us the life that we have here. So basically, what we want to do is look at the variation in this and decide how we can use that later and exploit it in our animal production systems and our genetic selection programs. The genome, loosely defined whole genome sequencing, is reading and recording all 3 billion bases in the cattle genome, and it's actually, in cattle, it'd be 6 billion bases because there's two copies of the whole genome, or two copies of each chromosome. So in a way, you might define it as reading all 6 billion bases, actually, instead of 3 billion. Most of that, you hear the term thrown out there once in a while, junk DNA, but it's not necessarily junk, but it doesn't code for proteins, actually. It's something called introns, and it's over 98% of the genome. Likely, there may be some regulatory functions that are associated with these introns, but we don't really know as much about the function overall, and it doesn't actually cause a functional protein to be formed from those introns. The rest of it, and the part that generally, at least physiologically, we often are interested on in are the exons, which would be the remainder, the other 2% or so, and these are the coding regions which are used to make proteins. And this is just an illustration, really, of how those proteins are produced from that genomic DNA. I don't want to go into a lot of detail here, but the important thing is you have these base pairs I was kind of showing before. These are actually base pairs on RNA, which is transcribed from DNA. And they're read across three at a time in groups of three. And based on those groups of three, there's this specific molecule called a tRNA that brings along with it an amino acid. Okay? That amino acid then is formed into a chain. A chain of amino acids loosely becomes a protein. And there's other gobbledygook biochemistry in this I don't want to get into right now. But it basically, this is how the proteins are formed from that genetic code. Okay? And the important thing is that we've got these three specific bases that actually code for these amino acids. And if one of these were to change in here, it would code for potentially a completely different amino acid than what's coming up there right now. Okay? That's where we get our variation in the proteins. Okay, I'm gonna give you an example of that, and where we see mutations and some of the sequence variation and how it affects maybe the traits that we see in livestock production today. Okay, this is an example of a fairly minor mutation right here. We've got all these amino acids right here, CAT, CAT, these are the DNA bases, the code, and this CAT codes for one amino acid all the way along. Okay? Well, we had a mutation occur in this one. This is a simple, what's called a missense mutation. And as a result of that, a CCT right here, and a different amino acid comes here, and we would end up with a protein chain that is likely very similar to the top one, but with one change in it. sometimes that one change and that one amino acid substitution causes a great deal of difference in the way that protein functions or the way that protein builds, makes building blocks, is whatever you want to think about it. Sometimes it doesn't. Okay? And this one, you know, may be fairly minor, may cause a biochemical reaction difference that may affect the function of growth hormone. As a result, we get different levels of growth rates in cattle between the two types of codes. Okay? That's just a simple example. Something much more extreme might be when one of these JIP bases in the DNA gets deleted. And let's just say right now that, although it doesn't say that right here, sorry about that, the C is kind of deleted, and we only read ATT instead of CAT, and we read CAC instead of PCA, and you'll see that this chain that's coming as a result of that code is now completely different in terms of the amino acids that exist there from the chain above. That's an example of very somewhat catastrophic change in the protein, and likely would produce something that has nowhere near the same function, may not even, in a lot of cases, something like this would be lethal to the animal. I mean, these are things that we see that might cause calves to never be born, or maybe never even get past blastocyst types of phases. Okay? There's all kinds of things that could be severe like this. Part of the genetic code actually codes for stop codons, which means this is the end of the protein change. You could get one little change like we had right here, but instead of producing another amino acid, it might produce a stop codon. And as a result, we end up with just a piece of a protein and another example of a protein that probably doesn't work the way it was intended. Often lethal, sometimes it just changes the function slightly. That's why we're interested in the sequence from a protein coding point of view and what we really are after with this sort of thing, what we're trying to see. And you can imagine, depending on how much this protein would change from one example to another, we have variation in the severity and how much it will impact the traits that we're interested in. Okay? So what's going on with cattle sequence and what's been going on? Well, less than 10 years ago, we just got the first beef cattle sequence. It was off this cow that's in the picture right here that came with a lot of help from Mike McNeil. I'm not sure he's in here, but I know he's at the meeting. Dominette, a Lion 1 Hereford female. And that cost at the time about $53 million to sequence. Okay, with a very large effort that started well before 10 years ago. Okay, but the discovery and the overall sequencing of Dominette multiple times so that she was covered very well led to some of the DNA chips that we've been using now for the past 5 years, the 50K chip, the Illumina chip, the high-density chips, and really it's made a lot of this genomic selection possible that we've been talking about BIF now for a number of years. And it's also been a base then for further sequencing projects so that basically if another cow or bull is sequenced, we can compare it to this dominant one and use that as a framework to build a new sequence for a different animal. If we think about just from the perspective of us on the Meat Animal Research Center, and that, I think this helps to give you a little bit of a historical perspective of what's gone on with sequencing over the years at the Meat Animal Research Center, these are some of the different systems we have, and I don't want to go deep into what the differences between all of these methods and systems are, but the point I really want you to look at is this is the cost of sequencing at the time per 1 million bases. Those bases we looked at were every 3 code for an amino acid. And you can see as the years went by, it went from $7,000 per million bases, mega bases, down to $3,000, down to $1,300 per mega base in 2003. And we thought, wow, we're doing great. This is getting cheaper. And then along came these new platforms. And I don't want to go deeply into these right now. To most of you that don't see these right now, these aren't much more than a nice coffee cup holder. But the point is these things do a lot of good work. The cost for sequencing per million base has come down tremendously. In fact, we've gone from that million bases that was about $1,300 there in the early 2000s now to somewhere around 5 cents to $10 per million bases, depending on which one of these next generation sequencing platforms were used. And I won't pretend that that means that the whole process is cheap, but if you were to just do the math for that $3 billion I talked about before, we'd be having enough sequence material. Don't get me wrong, it's not the whole sequence, but if you just multiply 5 cents times $3 billion, we'd have a $150 genome one time if we could just read the same chromosomal segments and only read them once. That's not feasible, and I'll get into that here in a minute. The accuracy of these new technologies ranges. Generally, some of these read a lot longer set of fragments than other pieces of technology here. And generally, the longer they read, the less accurate they are. That's not strictly true, but it's kind of a decent rule of thumb. And the nice thing is that if we're trying to build up a genome, the longer reads are a little easier to put together because you have better overlap and figure out how these pieces go together than you do in the shorter reads. So it's kind of a trade-off between usability for trying to put it all together and actual accuracy. So what are some complications with sequencing overall? Well, one is the initial cost, even though the cost for performing a single run or analysis to get the sequence data is cheap, the actual sequencer costs a lot of money, from $80,000 to $1 million. And you can imagine that takes a pretty hefty investment for any company or university wanting to look at this. The next one I really want to address, and I've hinted at it already, is genome assembly. And if we think about what we actually get, these are our initial chromosomes that we have, actually, and just laid out as sort of a flat representation of those chromosomes. And so this is what we want to read, right? But what we actually get out of the sequencer are these little bits right here, okay? And I know I've got a 5-year-old son that loves jigsaw puzzles, but it takes him way more than a couple of days to put all this back together again. All right. There's a lot there. We're trying to see basically how does this little part purple right here line up with another part purple and put them all back together again. Okay. It's not an easy problem. It requires a lot of computation. It requires a lot of algorithms, and it requires a fair amount of time just to make this sort of piece where we can almost piece together one of these chromosomal segments again. Okay. I don't want to belittle this at all. I want you to think about that. That's kind of what's going on and what needs to be done. Now, that said, there's a lot of research fields and a lot of programmers that are working pretty hard on this, and we have a lot more tools available to do this well than we did 5 years ago. The overlap helps. I hinted at this earlier. We can see overlap with the... Sorry. Get that picture back. We can see overlap in the colors. That might be unique coding regions that we can actually line up from one to another, and we know a little bit better how they fit together. It's like stacking ladders one on top of each other. Okay? And longer reads help as well in order to do that. And then comparing to a base sequence like that dominant cow I spoke of earlier also helps to make this process easier. There's a tremendous amount of data coming from the sequencing. It's hard to store, let alone manipulate, and try to figure out how to build it together. That makes assembly even tougher. And we have to develop tools based on the results. For example, genotyping based on new markers that are discovered in the sequence. That's where a lot of the 50K came from. It's hard to decide also what differences among animals are really important, because we have so many more differences than we have phenotypes. That's a problem we've echoed for a number of years just with the chip data alone. We have way more data than we really know, or way more information in terms of markers than we do in terms of phenotypes. It's just exploded that much more with the sequence data. Okay. we need to read multiple times. I mentioned if we had some way to force the sequencer to only read each part of the sequence once, we could just put it all together again, and we don't have to read through every animal twice, one for each copy of their genome, or each copy of the, each one for each chromosome. But unfortunately, we can't force that to happen. And as a result, this genome reading is really a random process into what gets read and what doesn't get read. Basically, if we're trying to look at the whole genome anyway. And so as a result, the same section of the genome is really likely read numerous times, and some people that really want to get this genome sequence for a single individual will end up sequencing 20 to 50 times before they feel like they've covered that well enough to be confident that they have that whole individual animal's genome. That's not necessarily something we advocate, and Warren will be talking about some results of doing it with much lower coverage here in a minute. From a genetics perspective, why do we care about the sequence overall if there's all these complications? And basically, we're interested in the sequencing in order to improve our chance of finding causal variation. Everything we're looking at right now, we're under the base assumption that what we see on the 50K arrays, array chip, the higher density arrays, are just markers and not necessarily the causal variation we're after in the first place. Okay, we're likely not hitting on the things that are really causing the phenotypes that we see. In general, it's very unlikely. And there's a few examples where we've seen mutations that we think are causal right now. One highly cited example is myostatin. We're pretty sure that we're actually hitting on the mutation that causes that, more than pretty sure. There's other ones in other species. We've got mucalpain, which is at least very close, if it's not the exact protein change causing region. But generally, that's not what we see. And so only by looking at the sequence do we think we can do a little bit better job of finding actual causal variation. Okay? And then ultimately, we want to get to the differences we see due to genetics that lie in differences in the genome or its regulation. There's two strategies for going forward then with the genome sequence, and one is sort of an older strategy that was used more with some of those earlier sequencing, and one is more of a newer strategy, but that requires a lot of phenotypes. Basically, one is to take diverse animals that vary by the traits we're interested in, as high, very high, and very low for the trait we're interested in, and then look along the genome, sometimes in candidate regions, and decide where they have sequence variation, and then try to explore that a little bit deeper to see if we can establish it being causal or not. Follow that up then later with genotyping forms to try to do it on larger sets of animals as a result. The other strategy is really to take the whole genome sequence as much as we can and try to relate all that variation we see in the sequence from animal to animal and match it to the whole phenotypic database that we have. And in broad shell, that's what we hope to do, but it's also very difficult, again, because we have so many more variants in our sequence than we do actual variation in numbers of phenotypic records. Okay. First strategy is much cheaper, but it's also more restrictive as a result because we're really picking out our regions that we're interested in. One way to move forward with this and a way to focus our efforts a little bit really has been focusing on these variants that seem to cause these protein changes that I mentioned earlier. And there's this whole list of variants that are categorized by different citations, and this is not the only citation that you can look at this, but it's an example of what we're trying to use. Sorry, that might describe a little bit what is actually going on in terms of the protein sequence coding that we want to do, and what's the impact of it on the severity of the change in the protein itself that we're interested in, the protein that might be causing variation. So, for example, I mentioned we could have stop codons that are created as a result of mutations, and the protein ends up being much shorter and probably functioning much differently, or that frame shift I mentioned where the protein looks completely different than it did before. Those would be examples of high-impact, very severe mutations, severe variants. There's other ones that might just be a codon insertion. I mentioned one of those earlier where just one of the amino acids changes in the whole protein change. Those are sort of moderate changes. and this is different ones. I don't want to get into the syntax of all these are, but they're not as severe. Generally, the protein may function similarly to what it did originally before the mutation happens. And then you end up with low impact types of mutations where the protein probably doesn't change very much at all. You just have another marker that you're looking at. And our hypothesis, and the hypothesis of several groups on several sequencing projects, is really try to focus on some of these moderate to high impact types of mutations and see what we can see in terms of the variation we see in traits. And so that's kind of a strategy for going forward. In summary, sequencing offers many possibilities. We can move toward causal variation. We can increase our selection opportunities. This can be extended to microbial types of interactions and try to sequence whole groups of microbes in order to look at economically relevant traits they affect. This would be like sequencing the bugs in the animal's rumen, maybe their lower GI, maybe sequencing bugs in nasal cavities for BRD, those types of things. That's a field called metagenomics. And then also, we hope that long-term, as Mark mentioned in his last talk, sequencing can be used to maybe lower genotyping costs. So we have a lot of potential for a lot of data, so now what is next? And I'm going to turn it over now to Lauren Snelling to describe some of the work that we've been doing at the Vienna Research Center.